When there's something cool on your movie screens, who you gonna call? Film Feeder! Hello and welcome back to the show, where every week I, your film chef extraordinaire Jack Martin, run through the biggest new releases coming to UK screens and also offer some of my insightful reviews that should persuade you even more to check them out on your own time. And if you couldn't tell from my sure-to-be-copyright-stricken opening, this week sees the release of a brand new entry in the popular Ghostbusters franchise, and I'll be getting into all the info about that film, as well as all the latest arrivals in cinemas, streaming, and on demand in my specially curated movie menu. And stick around, because not only will I be giving my thoughts on just some of the week's most noteworthy new releases, but I'll also be sharing a snippet of an exciting interview I conducted, so stick around for more info on that. But before I get into all of that, I've got a couple of announcements to make. The first being that after months of hard work, the online legend that is Matthew Buck, whom some of you may also know as Film Brain, has finally released his long-awaited podcast episode covering just some of the many films that he watched at the BFI London Film Festival last October. And I was very fortunate to co-host and provide a pair of ears, as he went into heavy detail as always with his thoughts on festival films like Hitman, Saltburn, May December, and many others. So this was a really fun experience for me, not least of all because it was, chronologically, my first ever appearance on a podcast, well before I even started this show, as well as the fact that Matthew was actually a big part of why I started down this path of film criticism in the first place, due to his association with a known brand that I think he and many others would prefer I not name drop, lest it give them more unneeded publicity. So to cross his path at arguably the country's biggest film festival, and then have him turn out to be as kind and considerate as he often comes across in his videos, was a truly heartwarming moment for me, and I'm eternally grateful to Matthew for allowing me the opportunity to come onto his show for the first episode in almost 2 years, in fact, and talk about everything from The Bike Riders to The Beast, see if you can guess which of those two movies turned out to be the far better one. So after you're finished with this episode of Film Feeder, then go and seek out that mammoth-sized version of the Film Brain podcast right now on Matthew's YouTube page, which I've added a link to in the episode description, as well as the likes of Spotify and many other audio or visual platforms. And the second announcement is that this week we'll also see the release of another feature presentation episode, which consists of an interview I conducted with the main creative talent behind the upcoming horror film Brightwood, including director and writer Dane Elkar and actors Dana Berger and Max Wertendyke. And let me tell you right now, I absolutely loved recording this interview. These guests were awesome to talk to, and I can't wait for everyone to hear it when it drops later on in the week. But anyone who subscribes on Patreon will not only get to hear it a whole day before everyone else, but will also have access to the video version of the podcast, which will not be made available anywhere else online. So head over to patreon.com/filmfeeder and subscribe today, where you can get that exclusive content as well as a whole other bunch of tasty treats. Also, make sure that you're liking or following this show on whichever platform you're listening to it on, and follow us on everything from Facebook to Twitter to Instagram and so on, all the handles and links to which you can find in the episode description. And perhaps most importantly of all, don't forget to visit the Film Feeder website at filmfeeder.co.uk, which is the only place on the internet where you can get access to all of my written content from the past 10 years and beyond. So for your regular fix of written reviews and previews, go to filmfeeder.co.uk. Right, so there's a lot to get through this week, and I've wasted enough time. Let's get right into this week's movie menu.
And now, preview time. When it comes to entertainment, you can't beat a good film. So let's take a look at what's coming your way.
First up, as ever, it's Film Feeder's Movie of the Week, which of course happens to be Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire, which after the Oklahoma-set previous sequel Afterlife, moves the action back to the Ghostbusters' iconic firehouse home of New York, which here is plunged into chaos when a brand new demonic spirit unleashes a new ice age onto the city, but not if Ghostbusters, new and old, can team up and take on the icy threat together. But if that isn't enough to sway you, then allow me to deliver 5 solid reasons why Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire is something to get truly excited about. Number one, it is the continuation of the iconic franchise that audiences have loved for decades, which has spawned sequels, reboots, cartoon shows, and even the legendary Ecto Cooler drink across its many years of service. Number two, while Afterlife director Jason Reitman is back as co-writer and producer on the film, he's handing directing duties to Gil Keenan, who previously impressed as the director of the Oscar-nominated Monster House, and also co-wrote Afterlife with Reitman, so you can expect some fun set pieces from a filmmaker with profound experience in the realm of crowd pleasers. Number three, it is an embarrassment of riches when it comes to who's on the team this time round, for not only do you have the majority of the Afterlife cast returning, including Finn Wolfhard, McKenna Grace, Carrie Coon, Celeste O'Connor, and Paul Rudd, but also some expanded roles for original cast members Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Ernie Hudson, and Annie Potts, who all showed up briefly last time, but have plenty more to do here in ways that might legitimately surprise you. And of course, there's some intriguing roles for newcomers like Kumail Nanjiani, Patton Oswalt, and British comedian James Acaster. Number four, the new threat that Ghostbusters new and old all face is by far the most powerful ghostly force yet, since their chilling powers could spell dire consequences for some of all of the teammates. And yes, that chilling pun was very much intended, as you'll find out when you see the film proper. And number five, it's an absolute treat for longtime fans who can look out for many exciting Easter eggs and other special surprises, while those less familiar with the franchise can enjoy the thrilling set pieces, top-notch visual effects, and a well-balanced mix of horror and comedy. So there you have it, 5 reasons why you should be excited for Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, which Sony Pictures is releasing in cinemas across the country from Friday the 22nd of March. Moving on now to the week's other cinema releases. First up is the buzzed about horror film Immaculate, which stars Sydney Sweeney, who also makes her debut as a producer with her new production company 5050 Films, as a young American nun who travels to a remote convent in the Italian countryside, only to run into all sorts of unexpected horrors along the way, especially when she mysteriously falls pregnant. Now, Immaculate will be one of the many films I'll be delivering my full thoughts on later on in the show, but for now I'll say that it's a film that is bound to become a talking point among audiences everywhere. You'll get the chance to see it when it arrives in cinemas via distributor Black Bear Films on Friday the 22nd of March. Then we have The Persian Version, the festival hit that focuses on an Iranian-American family with their fair share of issues, such as a rebellious daughter who unexpectedly becomes pregnant after a one-night stand, and who must now face up to her estranged mother, who, as it turns out, has her own difficult history that contrasts greatly with her children's current difficulties. Now, I'll also be talking about The Persian Version in more detail later on, but this is a funny and heartfelt family comedy drama from writer-director Maryam Keshavarz, who won the coveted Audience Award at Sundance for this film, which you can check out when Sony Pictures brings it to cinemas from the 22nd of March. Next up is Robot Dreams, which you may have already heard of as a somewhat unexpected nominee for the recent Best Animated Feature Oscar, and it tells the heartwarming and occasionally heartbreaking story of a dog in 80s New York who, to combat his loneliness, decides to build a robot designed for close companionship, which brings the two unlikely souls together and then apart again in ways that may just leave you bawling. Once again, this is a film I will be talking about a lot more later on, but Robot Dreams is a wondrous animated drama that makes you feel all sorts of emotions, some of which you might not necessarily have expected. And you can find it in cinemas thanks to Curzon on the 22nd, as well as on Curzon Home Cinema, where the film will be exclusively available to rent. We're heading back into horror territory now with Late Night with the Devil, a horrifying found footage chiller focused on an episode of a popular 70s talk show hosted by David Dastmalchian, who has, among his eclectic lineup of guests, the teen survivor of a satanic church's mass suicide, which leads to some disturbing on-air consequences that, quite frankly, need to be seen to be believed. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to see this one in time for a review, but I have to say that I am extremely intrigued by this film, not just because it's gotten some stellar reviews from critics, including horror legend Stephen King, but with a killer concept and a brilliantly constructed 70s aesthetic from filmmakers Cameron and Colin Cairns, this could well be an instant modern classic for horror fans everywhere. So make sure you catch Late Night with the Devil when Vertigo Releasing broadcasts it into cinemas from the Friday the 22nd. Then there's Baltimore, the tense biographical thriller from filmmaking duo Joe Lawler and Christy Molloy, who previously made a splash with their chilling debut Rose Plays Julie, and who here tell the fascinating true story of Rose Dugdale, a former debutante who became radicalised as a young woman and became a known activist for the Irish Republican Army, for whom she most famously led a daring art heist that saw some of the United Kingdom's most valuable paintings stolen and held for ransom. Imogen Poots portrays Dugdale here, and you can find out if she nails the role when I deliver my thoughts on the film later on, but it's another formidable role for the actor that should gain her some attention at the very least, after Icon Film Distribution puts it in cinemas from the 22nd of March. The last of this week's cinema releases is the quirky and unpredictable crime caper The Delinquents, which comes from Argentinian filmmaker Rodrigo Moreno, and tells the story of a bank clerk in Buenos Aires who concocts a plan to steal $650,000 from his place of work, confesses to the crime, and then have his colleague look after the money whilst he's in prison, which of course doesn't come without its own set of complications. Filled with feel-good vibes and a sunny disposition, not to mention plenty of oddball humour, you'll be perfectly entertained by this gentle and funny twist on the bank robbery formula, which Mubi is releasing in cinemas from Friday the 22nd of March. But it's not just cinemas getting a sizable chunk of new releases, for there are a considerable number of movies making their debut digitally this week as well, such as Prime Video and director Doug Liman's action-packed remake of the 80s cult classic Roadhouse, which stars Jake Gyllenhaal as a former UFC middleweight champion who takes a job as a bouncer at a remote bar in the Florida Keys, and soon uses his brutal fighting skills to keep the customers in line, which come in handy once boxing and MMA champion Conor McGregor comes into the mix, with the athlete making his acting debut here alongside the Oscar-nominated Gyllenhaal. Already receiving plenty of buzz following its recent premiere at the South by Southwest Festival in Texas, Roadhouse has all the makings of a potential new action favourite, and you can check it out on Prime Video, where the film will, somewhat controversially, land instead of in cinemas on Friday the 22nd of March. Over on Netflix, a different kind of fighter emerges in Shirley, the historical drama that stars Oscar winner Regina King as Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman to be elected to the United States Congress, and who in 1972 sets out to become the first black politician to run a presidential campaign, with mixed results to say the least. The film comes from writer-director John Ridley, who previously won an Oscar for his screenplay for 12 Years a Slave, and it features a bright cast that also includes Terrence Howard, Lucas Hedges, Andre Holland, and the late Lance Reddick in one of his final roles. And with its timely and powerful political themes, it's sure to be another hit for the streamer after their success with last year's Rustin, which nabbed Colman Domingo his first Oscar nomination. So make sure you queue up Shirley when it comes to Netflix from the 22nd of March. Another new film that I want to talk to you about before it makes its debut on several VOD platforms is Brightwood, a psychological horror that is the brainchild of director, writer, producer, cinematographer, and editor Dane Elkar, who tells the story of married couple Jen and Dan, played respectively by actors Dana Berger and Max Wertendyke, who during their morning jog suddenly find themselves caught in a mysterious and increasingly more terrifying time loop that they cannot seem to escape from. Having seen the film already, I can say that it is a real treat, one that is unpredictable, engaging, and most of all horrifying, which is everything you want a horror to be. And as a bonus, I was able to have a nice chat with the film's core trio of creative talent, including Dane Elkar, Dana Berger, and Max Wertendyke, who kindly took the time out of their busy schedules to talk with me about making the film, their influences for it, and just a whole bunch of stuff like the current nature of independent cinema itself. And while the interview was originally supposed to be part of this episode, we ended up talking at length about so much that I've decided to release the full interview as its own special one-off bonus feature presentation episode later on this week, which will also include my review for the film, so be sure to look out for that special episode in the coming days. But for now, here's a little clip of our conversation to keep your interest. I should first start off by saying congratulations on making such a fascinating film, and thank you all so much for joining me on the show. And so I guess starting with you, Dane, could you explain how this concept came about and how you were able to get it made?
I had done a short film back in 2018 called The Pond, which was basically kind of like an experimental version of this film to kind of see if the plot device would work. The idea that someone would get stuck in a kind of pond and going around in circles And I mean, initially, I just kind of had this vision of someone getting stuck, not able to get out of. And I would take my daughter on these jogs around this local pond that I would jog around. As I was making that short film, I always kind of thought how interesting it would be to have this couple and kind of throw them into this environment, especially a couple that's kind of on the rocks in their relationship, and kind of see how that would play out. And I had this kind of vague thought that that might be kind of a kind of a interesting metaphor for a crumbling relationship. And and then years later, Max and I, we'd been working on a number of projects, and we were in the middle of something that kind of fell through during the pandemic. And I had kind of been, I think I'd told him about the idea a few times about kind of this couple getting stuck, going around the pond, and he had seen the short film. And eventually, I just decided, I'd give it a shot and write the script, and I showed it to Max, and that's kind of how it all started.
Well, that's pretty cool. And obviously, Dana and Max, what were your thoughts upon reading the script that led you to decide that this was something that you guys wanted to do?
Yeah, so sort of as Dana alluded to, Dana and I have worked on a bunch of stuff. We actually met many years ago working one of the last video stores here in New York City. And so we've had like a long amount of time where we've collaborated on things. And I'm always looking for opportunities to collaborate with Dane. We're working together on his next film as well. And I just think he's a wonderful writer and director. And I liked the short film. And so when Dane shared this with me, I just thought, not only did I think like, oh wow, this is gonna be really fun and exciting, but given where the world was, we had Dane and I had been working on this other project. We thought it was gonna go. The pandemic happened, it fell apart. And I for one certainly like felt the deep creative need to make something and make something with people who I loved. And we had this opportunity and this script, although not written with a global pandemic in mind, was possible to shoot during that time. We shot in May of 2021. And so Dan and I sort of, we looked at this and said, okay, well, we felt devastated about that first thing falling through. We were like, well, we're going to make something. And let's make something that we can control, something that we don't have to ask permission to make, something that we can make with our own resources.
And
And
just to add, to use that environment as kind of like an artistic limitation, to use the limitations to our benefit in some ways. So we only can have a few actors. Let's use that. We can only have one location. Let's use that. Sorry, Max, go ahead.
no, that's great. And so I read the script and Dane and I started talking and said, okay, well, the really first big question is who's gonna play Jen? And Dana and I had done a play a couple years prior and had just had such an amazing fucking time working on that together. And so Dana really just popped immediately into my brain. And I said to Dana, I was like, listen.
He said to Dane about Dana. It's so hard,
Yeah.
who he's talking about. Continue, Max.
I
Well, I
can
just,
imagine the confusion.
yeah. I said to Dane, I was like, listen, I know a woman who I think is the perfect Jen. Her name is Dana. And I said, listen, I know, you have to meet her, you have to talk to her, obviously, don't promise me anything, but at least have a conversation. And I think, we set up a time for them to talk and they took it from there.
That's incredible. And obviously, Daniel, what were your initial thoughts on being approached like that and getting to really know this character that you play?
Well, like Max said, I mean, I remember where I was when I got a text from him about this movie. I was in a Kohl's actually in upstate New York. I don't know if they have Kohl's in the UK, but it's like this just big department. I don't know, like it's like JC Penney or something like that.
Okay, yeah.
But you know what I mean? Yeah. And it was December of 2021, and it was just like, no, it was December of 2020. It was bleak. Like it was a bleak time. And he sends me this text message that says, you wouldn't be interested in working on a indie horror movie with me in the woods, would you? And I was like, is that a joke? Of course I would. Like, first of all, I love Max, obviously. And we have so much fun working together. And the idea of like, oh, you just want me to come actually like do some art with you in a time when we've all been so isolated. and nobody's been working. And on top of that, I read the script. First of all, I would have done it. I don't know. I probably would have done it pretty much if it was anything, because I was so desperate for like human connection. But then I read the script and I was like, oh, this is actually good. Like, this is actually really interesting. And it's such a challenge to be one of two people in an entire movie, you know? And I think that like, that was so, so exciting for both me and Max to get to actually like do. Like, that's so much meaty work. And I think that like Dane was so open to having it be collaborative, which I think is very important for this kind of a movie where we are building something around two people and their relationship with each other. So it was just, you know, it was an actor's dream to get that offer.
Well, wasn't that a whole lot of fun? And once again, you can hear my full conversation with Dane Alcott, Dana Berger, and Max Wertendyke in a special feature presentation episode later on this week. And in the meantime, make sure that you're on the lookout for Brightwood, which will be available to digitally rent or buy via Cinephobia Releasing from Thursday, the 21st of March. Also available to exclusively rent or buy this week on digital platforms is A Million Days, a thought-provoking sci-fi drama set in the year 2041, when a group of astronauts led by Simon Merrills is about to embark on a monumental mission to create the first ever lunar colony. A mission that is put at risk when the mission's purpose-built AI reveals a chilling prediction that puts humanity's existence at risk, forcing the astronauts into a race against time to decide whether or not to carry on with the mission that they spent most of their lives working towards. So this is a smart and calculated piece of sci-fi cinema that takes a much more thoughtful approach than is often done within the genre, with some surprising results that come from plenty of cerebral debate. And you can find out what happens from today, Monday the 18th of March, which is when A Million Days becomes available to rent or buy from digital websites like Amazon, Sky Store, YouTube, and others. And finally, the week's big re-release comes courtesy of the one and only Martin Scorsese, who in 1985, shortly after his then long-gestating passion project The Last Temptation of Christ was put into turnaround, made a much livelier but no less gritty dark comedy by the name of After Hours, which starred Griffin Dunn as a New York yuppie who winds up experiencing one hell of a crazy night in the city's Soho district, and is now being put back into cinemas with a brand new 4K restoration, years after it became a cult classic despite only earning a measly $10 million during its box office lifespan. So for anyone who's ever wanted to see an underappreciated entry in the filmography of a legendary filmmaker like Martin Scorsese, then After Hours is something you'll want to be on time for when it comes to cinemas for a limited time from Friday the 22nd of March. And that about does it for this week's movie menu. Hopefully you've managed to pick out which ones you're most keen on being served, and I truly wish you a happy viewing experience, no matter which one you've ended up choosing. And now it's time for an absolute marathon of reviews, perhaps the most I've yet read out on this show, and there's plenty to get through, so here we go. I'm going to start off with the week's second biggest release, Immaculate, which has been circulating through development hell for at least a decade, to where its star Sydney Sweeney first auditioned for the lead role when she was 16 years old. The project clearly stuck in the actor's mind ever since, and now that she's gained some star power of her own, she's championed the emergence of Andrew Lobel's script into existence, via a quick rewrite to slightly age up her character, as a producer, her first such credit under her recently formed production company, 50/50 Films. As admirable as that is, it's not hard to see why Immaculate took so long to finally get made. For one, it gets into some very out there concepts involving religion and faith that may well cause some severe division, especially in a day and age where God-fearing Christians will spew fire and brimstone over anything considered remotely sacrilegious. It is also, to be blunt, not an especially great script, for it is overly reliant on a number of jump scares that often have little to do with the actual plot. However, for all of its flaws, it is made hugely entertaining by a combination of filmmaking and performance that ultimately give the film its holy spirit. The film stars Sweeney as Cecilia, a young nun who became a devout believer after surviving a near-death experience during childhood. After her American parish closes, she is invited to stay at a remote convent in Italy, which is populated by other nuns who vary from cautiously inviting to staring daggers at her from afar.
Shortly after arriving, Cecilia suddenly learns that she is pregnant, despite never breaking her chastity pledge, and her immaculate conception is deemed a miracle by the rest of the Covenant. However, of course, nothing is as it seems, and soon Cecilia finds herself trapped in a rather horrifying situation as her pregnancy slowly progresses. For its first half, Immaculate more or less hits many of the expected horror movie beats, with its inclusion of dream sequences that are heavy on jump scares, characters looking sinisterly at the main protagonist from a distance, and a cold open that sets the intense tone yet never factors back into the main narrative. Lobel's script feels like it regularly fell victim to one too many notes from studio executives that wanted more scary stuff, regardless of whether it works or not. Though many of them are fairly well executed, such as one dream sequence set within a confessional booth that stretches further and further into the darkness, they more often than not stop the movie in its tracks so that it can startle the viewer in a constant reminder that they are, indeed, watching a horror film. It's also one of those movies where you can tell pretty much right away who the villains are going to turn out to be, not least because they're constantly going about acting creepily for no real reason other than that they are the baddies, all while Sweeney's initially naive new arrival fails to notice the blatant red flags waving around her at this convent. Some characters don't even act like they're keeping any of their ill deeds a secret, since they regularly commit evil acts out in the open, or at least enough to where the main character can easily find them behind closed doors that are themselves highly accessible. One of the main villains also looks all too convincingly like Lucifer himself, whilst he's giving shifty eyes even in scenes where they're supposed to be charming and friendly, as though the audience hasn't already caught on to their distrustful nature. It plays out these reveals in all the ways you might expect, which makes the majority of the film pretty predictable. What isn't predictable, however, is exactly where this movie ends up going. It reaches a point around the break into the third act, where once you find out what's actually going on, it goes into some extremely out there ideas that border on science fiction, and not too far removed from the outlandish reveals during the final thirds of Get Out or Overlord. I'll admit that even though it was obvious who the villains were, what they were up to still came across as quite a surprise to me, as it never dawned on me until seeing it unfold that a movie like Immaculate was capable of going to these absolutely wild concepts. From that moment on, the film really does embrace its heightened non-sploitation identity, complete with some pretty gnarly but satisfying violence, with gore effects that are fun to watch, though there are some iffy fire effects at one point as well, but that trope is quickly discarded in a nice maneuver away from the whole evil goes down in flames convention. Part of what makes these ludicrous turns of this film's latter half so entertaining is the fact that director Michael Mohan, who previously directed Sidney Sweeney and Amazon's erotic thriller The Voyeurs, doubles down hard on the cathartic Tarantino-esque violence that one can often find in a similarly gory exploitation film from the 70s or 80s. There is also the exceptional commitment of Sweeney herself, as the actor powers her way through the monumental physical and emotional challenges set for her during this all-encompassing climax, right up to and including a final one-shot scene that features some incredibly raw acting, as well as a deeply uncomfortable vibe that is bound to cause a divide among viewers. The filmmaking, which also includes some impressively moody cinematography by Alicia Christian, truly does shine in this part of the movie, as it puts you right alongside Sweeney's character as she goes through some unnerving ordeals, while the actor makes this character, as thinly defined and overly naive as she can sometimes be, engaging and charming enough to actually root for her the whole time. Though it is a shame that the rest of the movie beforehand isn't as willing to embrace its B-movie roots, Immaculate is, at its best, appropriately unholy when it comes to delivering bonkers but fascinating horror entertainment. So in summary, Immaculate initially suffers from an over-reliance on unnecessary scares and a predictable, to a point, plot. But once it finally gets going and reveals the bonkers non-sploitation movie lurking underneath, it becomes much more entertaining, in part thanks to some effective filmmaking and a truly raw lead turn by Sidney Sweeney, which earns the film 3 out of 5 stars from me. Next, I've got my thoughts ready for Robot Dreams, an entirely wordless adaptation of Sara Varon's graphic novel of the same name by Spanish filmmaker Pablo Berger, which on the surface seems like a cutesy 2D animated tale set in a world of animals that appear to be far more basic than the further-reaching narratives of the other Oscar-nominated films for Best Animated Feature. Once you see Robot Dreams, however, you'll know immediately that it is many things, but basic is not one of them. It is, in fact, a deeply emotional study of the unbalanced nature of friendships, one that conveys its utterly heartfelt findings through some of the most charming visual storytelling you might just see in a film this year. Set in 1980s New York, within a world entirely populated by animals, we first meet the incredibly lonely dog as he's playing a game of Pong by himself in his apartment, before microwaving a mac and cheese TV dinner for one and scrolling through MTV and various cooking shows. He soon comes across a commercial for a new robot model designed for friendship, and he immediately orders one that, after a breezy construction, quickly becomes his inseparable best friend. However, while spending the day together at the beach, Robot finds he is unable to move due to low battery and growing rust, forcing Dog to abandon him for the night and come back the next day with the appropriate tools, only to learn that the beach is now closed until the following summer, separating Dog and Robot for even longer. And both of them try to get on with their lives in the meantime, which in Robot's case means dreaming a number of scenarios whilst he's lying on the sandy beach collecting even more rust, until the day that they are, hopefully, reunited once more. The title obviously comes from the various fantasies that Robot conjures up in his mechanical head whilst remaining in his singular location for most of the movie, including one involving a boat full of bunnies that ends up making things far worse for the paralyzed android, and another that defies the fourth wall and wanders straight into a Wizard of Oz-inspired tap dancing number. While those are engaging to watch, not to mention heartbreaking at times, the most poignant definition of the title Robot Dreams is the one that describes the unwavering bond that both Dog and Robot share with one another, as you see throughout the opening act how their instantaneous friendship brings out the best in both of them, and you can feel how genuinely happy they are to be together as they wander through the city dancing to Earth, Wind & Fire September on roller skates. It's to a point where, after they are forced apart, you really do feel their separation anxiety kicking in hard, especially with Dog, who, despite everything he does to try and socialize with others, cannot shake off his initial nerves that simply weren't there with Robot around. And as someone who constantly struggles in social situations to this day, I was exceptionally moved by the way that this film portrays that feeling of being alone while the world is seemingly out to get you, which happens often to both of its protagonists here, while variations of such events have undoubtedly happened to myself and other people who suffer from similar feelings of overwhelmedness whilst trying to make new friends. The choice to present Robot Dreams without a single line of dialogue, with the only vocal noises being non-verbal grunts and the lyrics to numerous 80s songs on the soundtrack, is incredibly generous on the part of writer-director Berger, for it allows the animation to do the heaviest of lifting when it comes to visually conveying the most emotional parts of this story. The colourful animation is wondrous to look at, as there is much to enjoy in every little detail within the background, including numerous references to 80s pop culture like street hip-hop, The Shining, various arcade games, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and more, while there is a clear love put into the hand-drawn character designs and street environments that cover everything from graffiti on the walls to the Twin Towers looming over the city in every other shot. You'd be hard-pressed to find a frame in this movie that isn't in some way bursting with colour and energy, all captured within a storybook-like style that immediately presents its visuals with a universal appeal. Most of all, though, the animation is vital to moving the story forward without any spoken words. You understand what each and every character is thinking through their varied facial expressions, in addition to picking up on their unique personalities that make them far from simplistic, which even some of the more innovating animated films out there struggle to convey through their overly expository writing. The animation here ends up saying far more than dialogue ever could, because it is dealing with themes that anyone can recognize right away, and without being explained how they should react to them, like their children. What Berger and his army of animators managed to do extremely well in Robot Dreams is to simply show these feelings for what they are, without dwelling too much on the why of it all, and instead just focusing on the immediate emotional impact it's clearly having on these characters, without any spoken words required or even necessary. People need to realise, now more than ever, that animation is not something made just for younger crowds. It's an all-encompassing medium that can tell all sorts of stories that anyone of any age can identify with and even have an emotional reaction to. And Robot Dreams is a perfect example of how artists, like the ones working on this film, can tell a universal tale about comprehensive topics like friendship and loneliness without relying on words to simplify things. On top of that, this is a powerful piece of cinema that looks gorgeous, has an enormous heart, and may even have you blubbing every time you hear September from here on. In all, Robot Dreams is a wondrous piece of animation that relies solely on its colourful visuals to tell a moving universal story about friendship and loneliness, which has so much emotion and charm to spare that it constantly reminds you of the true power of animation as a storytelling medium, and it gets the full 5 stars from me. Then there's the Persian version, which comes from writer-director Maryam Keshavarz and explores a largely untapped American subculture that is very much worth looking at. One only needs to look at the financial success of films like My Big Fat Greek Wedding, Crazy Rich Asians, and Black Panther to see that multiculturalism in cinema, as it is in real life, is thankfully here to stay. Audiences clearly love seeing other cultures being represented on screen, with ethnically appropriate ensemble casts, and, if they're willing, at least one token white person, acting out scripts that display wide varieties of cultures that the majority of Western audiences may not have even been aware of. And the Persian version clearly seeks to do the same with its own showcase of Iranian traditions. When it is simply being that showcase, the Persian version works fairly well. It's engaging, interesting, and even a little bit emotional, as it takes viewers on an energetic whirlwind tour of the Iranian-American experience. However, an ultimate lack of focus in the narrative that Keshavarz puts forward in her film, which is based very loosely on her and her family's own experiences, means that it doesn't retain as much weight as it is clearly capable of handling. Set in New York sometime during the 2000s, the film primarily follows Layla, played by Layla Mohammadi, a young Iranian-American woman who frequently rebels against the expectations of her more traditional family. She is sexually active, identifies as gay, and dresses provocatively in public, to where the very first time we see her, she's on her way to a costume party, draped in a niqab, covering her top half, but not the bikini she's wearing on her bottom half. Her attitude has particularly soured relations between her and her mother Shireen, played by Nuri Shanor, who by contrast is a sterner businesswoman that has supported her family since obtaining her realtor license, not too long after emigrating to America from Iran with her husband Ali Reza, who's Bijan Daneshmand. Soon though, Layla falls pregnant after a one-night stand with Tom Burns theatre actor Max, whom she at first thought was a drag queen but is just performing the lead in Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And when Ali Reza is admitted to hospital for a heart transplant, she faces an uncomfortable reunion with her estranged mother. However, Layla soon learns that her parents were at the center of a major scandal in their small village back in Iran, and as she discovers more about what actually happened to them, especially Shireen, the more she realizes just how similar to her mother she actually is. Like a rebellious young protagonist, Keshavarz immediately sets out to break many rules of conventional filmic storytelling. Characters repeatedly break the fourth wall, stylized captions take up half the screen, fantasy sequences see people literally frozen in place, and there's even an impromptu choreographed dance number sent to Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Wanna Have Fun, much of it before the main title even pops up. Keshavarz is certainly trying to emulate a style similar to the flashier works of Martin Scorsese, who is even name-dropped at one point as an influence for Layla, who is also an aspiring filmmaker, and it is one that she is clearly fond of since she admirably does whatever she can to put that peculiar liveliness into any scene that she can, with fast-paced editing and grounded cinematography to support her vision. However, the style quickly overtakes the substance, as so much will be happening all at once that there will be significant parts to this particular story that you'll just forget about due to all the other stuff that's piling on top of it. One minute, this family will be fretting over their patriarch's impending heart surgery, and the next they'll be enjoying a normal dinner where they're swapping banter with each other and reacting to some awkward news. Then the film spends a great deal of time going into the rather harrowing backstory of one major character, before cutting back to the present when someone is getting married and another is on the verge of having an unplanned baby, both of which have been off-screen for so long that you'd be forgiven for forgetting these strands were even in the film to begin with. And finally, just when things seem as though they're finally moving in the right direction, it comes to an end, with a number of plot threads left dangling or only partially resolved. The focus is all over the place, and the style, as eye-catching as it may be, ultimately doesn't help the viewer to truly comprehend who, what, or even where said focus should be in the moment. When it calms itself down and actually allows itself to explore Iranian-American culture for the sake of a novice audience, the Persian version is much more effective. Keshavarz details the interesting difficulties that come from being Iranian-born and American-raised, with the hostile disagreements between both nations seeping into the childhood experience of Layla Mohammadi's Layla, such as her being racially profiled in an American school, as well as shunned for her American behaviour while studying back in Iran. For the previous generation, as Keshavarz shows, it was even more difficult, as we see in a lengthy flashback the harsh and rather traumatic tribulations that Layla's mother Shireen had to endure whilst living as a teenage bride in an isolated Persian village. Beyond these scenes giving valuable insight into a culture that few mainstream audiences may be aware of, they are among the more powerful and heartfelt in the whole film, because you can tell that Keshavarz is coming at it from a truly personal angle, with a gentle sentimentality that means a whole lot to her, and it shows in some of these truly moving moments. if the film had put its focus on just that rather than bombard itself with so much other stuff that ends up cluttering the final product, then maybe the Persian version would have been on the same level of quality as those other multicultural hits I mentioned earlier. As is, it's a noble but flawed look at a culture that nonetheless deserves its time in the spotlight. So in short, the Persian version is a stylish multicultural comedy drama that is at its best when it's exploring the Iranian-American culture and the moving backstories of some of its characters. But an overly energetic style piles on several strands all at once, rendering it somewhat unfocused and with an overall rating of 3 stars. And finally, I have my review for Baltimore, which I first saw at last year's BFI London Film Festival, and with it finally gaining a cinematic release this week, it seems fitting that I deliver my initial thoughts on the film from back in October. And as a reminder, you can also hear the collective thoughts of myself and Matthew Buck on his own podcast episode about the London Film Festival, the YouTube version of which is linked in the episode description. So the film, as I mentioned earlier, is a starring vehicle for Imogen Poots, who is one of those actors that you're constantly waiting to see break out, but so far hasn't quite found the right role with which to do so. She's certainly come close a few times, with memorable supporting turns in the likes of 28 Weeks Later, Filth, Green Room, and The Father, but more often than not, she'll be saddled with material that is well beneath her talents, whether it's douchebag-ridden comedies like That Awkward Moment, or her arguably thankless role in The Awful Need for Speed, or whatever the hell she was doing in the 2019 remake of Black Christmas. Baltimore should, in a lot of respects, finally be the one to put Poots on the map. It's a challenging and complex role, at least on the surface, one that the actor is excellent at slipping into. But the problem lies in the fact that the script, direction, editing, and even the music all seem to be actively working against it, which makes the film all the more disappointing to sit through. The film, from filmmakers Joe Lawler and Christine Molloy, previously the understated psychological thriller Rose Plays Julie, is about the exploits of Rose Dugdale, the former debutante turned political activist, and eventual ringleader for one of the biggest art thefts in history. Poots, of course, plays Dugdale, who grew up in a wealthy household but quickly became radicalised after studying at Oxford, where she becomes part of the movement against sexual discrimination, and later forms part of an underground group sympathising with the Irish Republican Army, especially after the events of Bloody Sunday. Dugdale soon leads 2 accomplices, Dominic, played by Tom Vaughan Lawler, and Martin, played by Lewis Brophy, on a daring mission that sees them invade a wealthy manor in Ireland, with her donning a thick French accent and long orange wig, and nab some of the priceless paintings on display, and hide out in a remote house where they feed the authorities their demands in exchange for the artwork's safe return. You'd think a film about someone whose life story is this interesting, going from a wealthy upbringing to a state of political radicalization, would be more exciting to watch, but Lawler and Molloy's unfocused approach renders it far less inviting than it should be. Baltimore is a film that follows a non-linear structure, constantly going back and forth between the art heist, the immediate aftermath, and aspects of Dugdale's life before her activism, but there is hardly a consistent thread running through it all that ties it all together, with some cuts between the past and present feeling sporadically put together, to a point where their tones don't always seem to match. One moment you'll be in the middle of a tense situation as Dugdale and her accomplices are violently threatening their captured hostages, and then it'll cut to those same characters doing virtually nothing inside of their hideout home. Its stop-and-start approach disrupts the level of engagement in this narrative, which ends up making it all feel less tense and more frustrating to watch. Since the film's structure is all over the place, it's hard to get a true grip on its central character, and why this figure is important enough to warrant her own biopic. The film skips over a lot of crucial events in Dugdale's early activism career, including a training session in Cuba that is reduced to one throwaway line of exposition dialogue, while an even earlier event that saw her and her lover get caught robbing her parents' house is largely portrayed as a call-to-arms moment that says nearly nothing about her character beyond her sudden extremist views. The viewer never really gets to find out why she's so active in her crusade of support for the IRA, except for some simple close-up shots of her crying whilst watching news footage of Bloody Sunday, as the film sidesteps further context in favour of suspense that doesn't really land because, again, we still know next to nothing about this character. In fact, one quick visit to Rose Dugdale's Wikipedia page will instantly give you more information about this person than the movie cares to get into. It is a shame because, once again, Imogen Poots is genuinely giving a very strong performance here. She is effective at conveying her character's growing anger for the state of the world, and at times can be quite intimidating as she toys around with people's unnerved states of minds. She easily comes out strong from what is otherwise an underwhelming movie as a whole, which doesn't have a consistent enough focus or a level of depth to truly explore this figure as much as it should, and lacks a real spark that makes this fascinating real-life story seriously crackle on the big screen. Sadly, it seems that Poots is still on the hunt for that inevitable breakout role, because Baltimore certainly isn't it. So to summarise, Baltimore is a disappointing attempt to dramatise the interesting life of debutante-cum-activist Rose Dugdale, which, despite a strong turn by Imogen Poots, lacks the focus and intrigue to make her story work on the screen, and it sadly earns 2 stars from me. And that does it for another episode of the show. If you stuck around until the very end, then thank you ever so much for listening, and I hope you had a good time hearing my film-centric ramblings. If you enjoyed it, then don't forget to follow Film Feeder on our many social media channels, handles and links all being in the episode description. And please do consider subscribing over on Patreon at patreon.com/filmfeeder, as well as visiting the Film Feeder website itself at filmfeeder.co.uk. I look forward to welcoming you back next week when I'll be taking a look at upcoming releases such as The Mighty Godzilla X Kong: The New Empire. But until then, I'm your film chef extraordinaire, Jack Martin, whetting your appetite for film each and every week. That's all for now. See you next time.